You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Tuesday the 26th of November 2019, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at radioalbion.com. Well, I'm very pleased to say today we have with us our much-respected eyewitness to history, Mr. I. Mr. I, how are you doing today, sir? I hope you are well.
Yes, very well, thank you.
Excellent, excellent. That's good to hear. And we were talking last week, or you suggested last week, that we talk about Lady Moseley this week, and I've really been looking forward to that. So please do begin and tell us about Lady Moseley.
Well, Lady Moseley was one of the Mitford sisters who were the most well-known women in the society of the 1930s. There was Nancy, who was a novelist. Unity, who was a friend of Adolf Hitler. Jessica, who married a Canadian, Esmond Romilly, who was killed during the war, serving in the Canadian Air Force, although she had communist leanings. Pamela, she took very little part in society. She was more of the homely girl, who the other sisters used to cry on her shoulder, sort of thing, you know, like. And then, of course, Diana, whose first husband was Jonathan Guinness, the heir to the Guinness fortune, and extremely rich. That marriage went on the rocks when she met and fell in love with Sir Oswald Moseley. He had been married to Lord Curzon's daughter, and who unfortunately died of she had appendicitis that I forget what it is that follows it, and which killed her. Peritonitis. Yes, peritonitis. And of course, then there wasn't the drug penicillin, which could have cured her. So unfortunately, she died. And then she met Diana Mitford. And she had divorced Jonathan Guinness by then, and her sister Unity, who I mentioned was a friend of Adolf Hitler, took her on holiday to Munich, and Unity used to go to a hotel where she knew Hitler used to go regularly to lunch. And they were there one day, and Hitler noticed these two good-looking, blonde, blue-eyed English girls and invited them to his table. And that's how Diana came to know Hitler quite well, because later they visited him in his Berghof, the house he had built in the Bavarian mountains. They became quite good friends, and they remarked on how Hitler was an extremely courteous, and well, of course, he was the type of man that women would fall for, you know, being a strong man. And so a friendship developed there. But, of course, unfortunately, the war came, and which upset Unity so much that she got hold of a revolver and went and sat in the English gardens in Munich and shot herself. Now, unfortunately, she didn't kill herself outright, but a bullet lodged in her brain, and so she was more or less, although she was still alive, a cabbage, that's what they call them, the people who've lost their mental powers through an injury. And so that was very sad indeed. Now, back to Diana. Mentioned she had divorced Jonathan Guinness and met Sir Oswald, who had lost his wife, and they struck up a friendship, which led to a marriage, and that took place in the British Embassy in Berlin, with Adolf Hitler as one of the guests. In his first marriage to Cynthia Curzon, attending that marriage was the King of Belgium and the Sir George Mendel, an extremely wealthy Jew who made his fortune in Argentina. So it's quite a mix of people at his two weddings. Anyway, back to that Lady Diana. She didn't play any part, really, in the black shirt movement. She played the sort of role of wife and then mother to his son Max, and because the war broke out, and in May 1940 the notorious First Amendment to the Defence Regulations were made, and Mosley was arrested and incarcerated in a concentration camp. And Lady Diana, with a week-old child, I think he was only 6 days, not quite a week, days-old child, wasn't arrested at the time, but she put restrictions on her movements were imposed. Now, a few weeks later, they did arrest her, because what was happening, the members of the BUF who'd been arrested were up to then, I think, almost all men, and their wives and families were left destitute with no income at all. So Lady Diana, she tried to help them. She set up a fund to assist these the families of those incarcerated, and that was regarded as a breach of the conditions imposed on her, and she was arrested and imprisoned in Holloway Prison, the women's prison in Holloway. Now, as I explained, she had a child not quite a week old, so she had to arrange for a nanny to look after the baby, and as she was breastfeeding the child, she had to take a breast pump with her into prison to relieve herself. Now, it was absolutely wicked. Oh, dear. It makes me very angry, but there it is. And they mostly have been arrested, and then they did, when another important person was Admiral Sir Barry Donville, who organised what he called the Link, which was an Anglo German Friendship Association, and he was arrested with his wife, and they were imprisoned in Holloway, and then they decided that Lady Moseley should join Sir Oswald there, so they had the two top pro-German. Well, not exactly pro-German, but those who wished for friendship with Germany, incarcerated in the same prison. Moseley suffered very badly from three pointers, I think it was. Which was due to his service in the First World War in the trenches, you know, through having constantly wet feet and legs in the terrible conditions there. And he was discharged, and of course very severe restrictions were placed on his movements outside of the prison. And then Lady Moseley was allowed to join him there, also under strict, very strict restrictions as to their movement and so on. And then eventually the war ended, and they were released, along with others. Some had been held for as long as 4.5 years, you know, without charge or trial, term set or anything, which is totally contrary to the Habeas Corpus Act and the Magna Carta. But then, of course, you see, Churchill had, with the help of his wealthy Jewish patrons, had manoeuvred himself back into the cabinet, became Prime Minister, appointed himself as War Minister with completely unrestricted powers. Lady Moseley, after the war and her release, she did still try to help these people, and also funds for the orphan children in Germany. That was something else which the government didn't approve of, but they couldn't do anything about it because the war was over then, and so they couldn't impose any restrictions on her activities in that respect. Now, when she was imprisoned, they were able to appear before a sort of tribunal, and they who would decide on whether the Home Secretary was justified in incarcerating them. And she was duly questioned. And, you know, instead of cringing and apologising or anything like that, when they asked her, is it true that you have advocated that certain policies of Adolf Hitler's should be adopted in Britain? She said, yes. You know, and of course that absolutely shocked them. They thought she was going to cringe and say, oh no. That's an extremely brave girl. She was, but very brave indeed. Yeah. So also they were released, and mostly bought a farm, and he was ostracised so much in Britain that they went to live in Ireland for a while. He was one of the very few British politicians who were welcomed in Ireland because of his opposition to the activities of the, what they called the Black and Tans, who committed certain atrocities in Ireland. And so he was welcomed there, and he lived there for some time. Unfortunately, we hope it was accidental, but the farmhouse burnt down, and a lot of both his and Diana's records of family heirlooms and things were destroyed, which is a great shame, because he still with great difficulty, and he had adopted this post-war plan for a united Europe, and they went to live in Paris, where he was much freer to pursue his post-war political aims. And Lady Maudsley went with him, and first of all, they lived in a house that was built for one of Napoleon's generals. It was a grand house, and of course, people used to say, oh, look at them, you know, living like aristocracy in France. But I think when, that's right, Maudsley died in 1980, and she gave up this grand house and went to live in an apartment in one of the thoroughfares in Paris, which I can't remember exactly where it was, but I could say, because in her, I kept the last letter she wrote to me, which ended, "Always nice to hear from old friends," which of course I treasure. And she died. She would have been just over 80 years of age when she died. And a lovely woman altogether who we should honour.
Definitely, definitely. That's fascinating to hear. I'm particularly interested in Unity Mitford as well. I mean, to be so affected by the war that she effectively tried to kill herself. I mean, quite a statement, isn't it? Quite a statement to make. Yeah. I mean, the poor woman was then, you know, in a terrible state for years after. I mean, what was the response to that like in Britain upon hearing that news? Can you remember that at all?
The people in Britain, I believe I mentioned this in a previous talk, that they were just glad that the war was over, and that was it. They wanted to forget about it. I know the general atmosphere amongst the population was, they didn't care what the peace settlement was about or anything like that. The expression going around was, "Oh, thank goodness, no more bombs." That was the general attitude of the British people when the war ended. There was no, well, of course, the usual people who make any excuse for going, making a nuisance of themselves in Trafalgar Square. but generally speaking, the people have had enough of the war, and of course the prospects weren't very good because rationing and shortages went on for another 9 years. So it wasn't an immediate return to peacetime conditions. And of course, we had all the trouble with Russia and the Korean War. So there's really nothing to celebrate. Also, apart from the fact that the air raids had ended.
What was the response to her setting up this fund for the German orphans? You say that the authorities weren't very happy about that. I mean, did that receive coverage in the press? Did people want to donate to it, or were they just not interested?
Unfortunately, the general attitude was, well, it serves them right. They started the war, which of course they didn't. Our propaganda machine was saying they were so awful, and of course all this wretched Holocaust story had come out, and so the people's attitude was, oh well, it serves them right, which is shameful, really.
It is, but there wasn't much chance to find out any different at the time, was there? I mean, the newspapers were all in same cabal's hands.
They told the truth. They've been fed on lies, ever since Hitler came to power, really. So they'd had 12 years of propaganda against him. And, of course, in those days, people tended to have more faith in politicians then. All English politicians are above reproach. They wouldn't tell lies. Oh dear, wouldn't they?
It's really shocking to think about. I mean, at least today we have the internet and people can find out what's really going on, but we still have this same propaganda that stirs up feeling against places like Iran, Libya, Syria, Iraq, and comes out with these atrocity stories and tries to encourage us to
war. It's all the time, isn't it?
Yeah, constantly. I mean, it's the same thing, but I think more people are aware of it now. I mean, in the BUF literature that they were putting out, because they had Action newspaper and other ways to talk to their people, were they getting the truth out about Germany in that sort of literature? Was there an alternative media at all, alternative newspapers, or was there just the BUF Action newspaper?
Well, certain newspapers, for example, the Daily Mail, they were sympathetic because, you know, they had that famous headline, "Hurrah for the Black Shirts." they were sympathetic to a lot of things that Hitler was doing. And who else was it?
Daily Express?
There was the Daily Express exposing the Jews when they published the headline, "Judea declares war on Germany." That was in 1933. The moment Hitler came into power. So the newspapers generally were aware of what was going on, and to some extent much more honest, I might say, in those days. But they would talk about such things and give another viewpoint, which you don't get now, was you know, they've got their certain policies, and they don't give the opposition much chance.
Did they talk about the economic changes that Adolf Hitler made in Germany? Did they talk about any of his policies in a good light at all?
Yeah, well, of course, that was the attraction to everybody of the National Socialist regime. Because without borrowing a single penny from the international capitalists, he reduced, in the 6 years, he reduced Germany from 6 million unemployed to virtual full employment. And he did it through financing his own big plans, like the construction of the autobahns. And the building of the Volkswagen, the people's car. And of course, Mussolini, fascist regime in Italy, had big public works, reorganizing and modernizing the railway system, and draining the marshland, which banished malaria from Italy. So there was that sort of thing, whereas we were just stuck with conventional economics and suffering unemployment right up until the war started. And you see, they said, oh, well, Hitler ended unemployment with his massive armaments drive, which is wrong, because the German people, having money to spend, they wanted consumer goods. They didn't want bombs or shells or tanks or anything. They wanted consumer goods. And it was quite amazing how late in the war it was that they turned over. Well, of course, this was the work of Albert Speer, to their massive output of armaments. Despite all the Allied bombing and that, their production of armaments increased right the way through the war. And that is why we switched from bombing military targets and their in industrial areas to what they called area bombing of working class districts in the towns which were less heavily defended by anti-aircraft guns and night fighters, which was a shocking thing, because when you think as a deliberate policy, we burnt babies alive in their cots. And then, of course, they go, oh, what about the Holocaust and that? Whereas if it was true, one whiff of cyanide gas and they were dead. But as I say, we burnt babies alive, old men and women as well, with our massive firebomb attacks, where they got uncontrollable firestorms, like in Hamburg. Dreadful. And, of course, worst of all was Dresden, where they never knew how many casualties were caused, because not only was it the civilian population living there, but the thousands of refugees who'd been turfed out of their homes further east by the advance of the Russian army.
How was that justified to the British people in the press? How is it justified that Britain was bombing these civilian areas?
Well, I don't think the people were made aware of it. It was just a tactical or strategic decision by the Air Ministry. I can't recall people knowing about it. But in any case, they wouldn't... I don't think the people would have cared much, because they said, well, look at the people we lost in burnt alive in fires and things. It's hard to explain. It's a different mindset, really, where we're doing things to them which, whether by accident or design, they've done to us.
And you're in the war to win it as well. I mean, that's the thing. They're in the war to win it. And, I mean, it should be won by honourable means, but there's another... I mean, even Hitler said, because he wasn't happy about the breaking off to play football in the First World War. You know, he said, you want to get the war over with as quickly as possible. Oh, I don't want to be having a break. Yeah. So, I mean, there is that argument to be made that, you know, that firebombing was an attempt to get the war finished quick and to win it. So, you know, there's both arguments. Anyway, we've reached the end of the podcast here, Mr. I. Thank you so much for that. I really appreciate that. Our listeners are really going to enjoy that as well. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I will be back tomorrow with Carolyn Yeager. God bless and hail victory.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.